Welcome back to the program. Why do certain products and ideas become so popular? Why are some stories and rumors more infectious than others? And what makes online content go viral? These are just a few of the fascinating questions that Wharton marketing professor Jonah Berger explores in his new book, Contagious: Why Things Catch On. Berger has spent 10 years studying social influence, and his research and ideas are frequently featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Harvard Business Review. It is my pleasure to welcome Jonah Berger to the program today to talk about Contagious. Jonah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
One of the things that's so remarkable about something as important is understanding why certain things are successful and why some things aren't, is what you discover early on is how little research, real hard research, has been done in this area.
It's amazing to see the sort of the intuition that's out there. Some people say that it's random, that it's luck, that it's magic. Other people think that it's all about advertising. If you want your product to be a hit or you want your idea to catch on, you need to spend a whole bunch of advertising dollars. But in looking into it deeper, we found that there's really a lot of hard science there. There's a lot of understanding why people talk and share things, and there's some rules or principles that we can draw from these studies to understand why people behave the way they do.
But even in the framework of these principles, to what extent are they absolute? To what extent are they finite? In other words, one can fulfill all of the points of these principles, and we'll go through all these steps later, and still have a product or something that is not a success or that doesn't catch on.
I don't mean to suggest that following these principles will give you a billion hits on YouTube or will guarantee that your product will be successful. No one can do that. If I could do that, I would be in a different line of work. But it's more like thinking about, let's say, a batting average in baseball. No player hits a home run every time they get up, yet there are scientific tools that they can use to become better hitters. They can learn how to hold the bat a certain way. They can exercise in particular ways and tone their muscles. They can learn certain things about the way that pitchers pitch so that they raise their average, so that they increase the chance that they do well. And the same thing is true here. Most products and ideas, some people are already talking about them. And what our work does is show how you can get more people talking about them, how you can increase the chance that people talk about and share your idea with others.
How much of it has to do with timing, the way a particular idea or product or video, for that matter, goes into the market at a certain point in time when there is more receptivity to it?
Timing definitely matters, and receptivity is definitely important. That said, that's about the creativity of applying these ideas. We're really psychologists. We understand what makes someone share a certain story or pass along a certain rumor, but you're very right that a given emotion, for example, what makes someone feel angry at one point in time may be different than what makes them feel angry at a different point in time. What is surprising and novel, 1 month might not be surprising and novel in another month. And so while surprise and novelty drive people to share, you really do have to think about the context in which you're working.
Because one of the key points you talk about are the idea of triggers, the idea of what makes information top of mind. Talk a little about that.
Many people are familiar with the music artist Rebecca Black. A few years ago, she had this hit song called Friday, got over 300 million views. But it's sort of funny because everyone hates the song. It's a 16-year-old girl. She's from Southern California. Her parents paid a few thousand dollars to a music company to make a hit for her. They come out with an overproduced number that's about those big teenage difficulties like getting up in the morning, going to school and figuring out whether to sit in the front seat or the back seat of your friend's car. Not necessarily, weighty, heavy stuff. People have panned the song. They've said it's the worst song ever, yet it has 300 million views. Why? Well, if you look at the data, and we did, you see that there's a spike in searches for Rebecca Black. Then it goes down. And then a few days later, another spike, and then it goes down, and a few more days later, another spike, and then it goes down. But if you look more closely, the spikes aren't random. It's not chance. They're actually 7 days apart, and if you look more closely, you'll notice that every Friday is a spike in attention for this song. This song is equally bad every day of the week. It's bad Monday, it's bad Tuesday, it's bad Wednesday. But Friday, because that's the same as the song's name, provides a reminder in the environment, what we would call a trigger, that triggers people to think about the song, to listen to it, and to share it with others. And so triggers are a big and important driver of what people talk about and share. It's like if I said peanut butter and, most people would say jelly. Peanut butter is like a little advertisement for jelly. It triggers us to think about it, even though it's not there.
You made the same point in a piece that was in the New York Times with respect to children's names as it relates to hurricanes, in fact.
This is a very surprising finding for many people, but we found that after, let's say, Hurricane Katrina, baby names that begin with the letter K actually increase in usage by about 9%. And you might say, well, hold on, who would name their child after Katrina? Who would name their child after a hurricane? And the important thing to note is we weren't actually looking at whether people name their child after the hurricane, and that may or may not happen. We were looking at whether to give their child similar names, because that sound, the hard K sound that begins the word Katrina, they're hearing it more in the environment. And what we found in our research is, sure enough, when, you know, Karen is popular, other names like Karen are going to be popular this year, but other K names are going to be popular as well. And so, just as you were talking about the context, sometimes what becomes popular depends on the popularity of similar things at that point in time.
How much of it has to do with context? I mean, everybody's had the experience where they go out and they're thinking of buying a white car, and suddenly they see more white cars on the road than they ever imagined. It's not that there are more of them, it's just that their context for viewing it has changed.
Context, again, it definitely matters. I mean, we did some research looking at how social influence affects car purchases, and we found that if your neighbor buys a new car, for example, you're more likely to buy a new car. Even though you'd think, wait, doesn't my car buying depend on whether I need a new car or, you know, how expensive they are? But merely seeing others drive a new car can actually make you more likely to buy one, particularly if you live in an area where it's easy to see what others are driving.
One of the other things you talk about is social currency. What do you mean by that?
Social currency is the idea that what we say, just like the clothes we wear, the car we buy, affects how other people see us. We talk a lot about restaurants, people assume we're a foodie. We talk about a lot about technology. People will assume or know a lot about that. And so people talk about and share things. One reason they talk about and share things is based on how it makes them look. They talk about and share stories that make them look smart and in the know rather than, you know, not so smart and behind the times. They talk about a day of golf where they scored really well rather than one they scored really badly. They talk about a restaurant they picked or a recipe they made that everyone loved rather than one that they hated.
Talk a little bit about the importance of emotion, because that seems to be the central core of this whole thing, that we share that which we care more about.
Emotion is one of the important drivers of sharing, one of the six we talk about in the book, but it's actually not in the way you might expect. So you might think, well, people share positive emotions, but they don't share negative emotions. They want to look good, but they don't want to look bad, so they pass along positive things rather than negative ones. And sure enough, if we look at YouTube, for example, we see lots of positive, you know, funny videos being shared, and we can say, okay, humor drives sharing. But it's sort of puzzling that if you look at, let's say, op-eds, because often op-eds are highly shared, not because they're positive, but because they're actually angry-inducing. They make people more fired up and angry. And so are these two totally different things, humor and anger, or might there be something similar? And when we looked at it more deeply, we found that indeed there was. So while humor is a positive emotion and anger is a negative one, they share in common that they're both activating emotions. They fire people up and they drive them to action. And we found that any emotion that activates people, whether negative like anger, anxiety, or positive like humor, like excitement, like awe, are going to encourage sharing.
Talk a little bit about some contemporary examples of products or books or things that have really taken off that are surprising on one level, but yet less so when analyzed against these various steps.
Your listeners might be familiar with a company called BlendTech or the videos they've made, Will It Blend? But they're a really interesting story because sitting there you'd say, well, hold on. Sure, some products might get lots of word of mouth, things like cool bars or neat cars or hot technology, but no one would talk about boring, you know, stuff like, I don't know, cement or toilet paper or a blender. And BlendTech actually figured out how to get millions of views for a really mundane product, like a blender. So the story goes that they hired a new marketing guy. One of his first days in the office, he comes in and he notices a big pile of sawdust on the floor. And he asks one of his colleagues, well, what's going on? Are we expanding? And his colleague says, no, the CEO is doing what he does every day, try to break blenders. And so the CEO of the company would actually take 2x4 pieces of wood, golf balls, marbles, toss them in a blender, and see if the blender was tough enough to cut it. he wanted to make a really tough blender, and so he wanted to try to break it to see if it would work. And the marketing guy thought this was genius, so he took a $50 marketing budget, not $50 million, not $50,000, but $50, filmed a CEO doing what a CEO is already doing, and put it up on the web. And my favorite example of these videos is one where they blend an iPhone. You're probably sitting there going, how could they blend an iPhone? There's no way. But yet he presses the smoothie button, and sure enough, it goes, the blender starts right up, and the iPhone gets torn to shreds. It gets reduced to glass and dust and a little piece of metal. And that video's gotten over 10 million views. The set has gotten over 100 million views for a regular, everyday blender. And sales went up 700%. And so it's a great example of even how mundane products, boring everyday products, can get a good bit of word of mouth if people understand the drivers that encourage sharing.
How does the Steve Jobs idea, speaking of iPhones, the Steve Jobs idea that, in fact, people don't really know what they want, they need to be told what they want, how does that fit into this equation, Jonah?
I read the Steve Jobs book. It was a great book. I don't necessarily agree that consumers need to be told what they want. That said, it's not that behavior is unpredictable. It's not like we can't get any traction on how people behave. And so to me, it's about understanding why people talk about and share things, and how we can use those principles to help good products and ideas become more popular. Word of mouth isn't going to help a bad product. All it's going to do is let lots of people know that you don't have something that's great. Really, you need to think about making a good product in the first place, and then how you can get people to talk about and share that thing that everybody already likes.
Is there a difference, and does the kind of product make a difference? In other words, a book, is that different, for example, or a movie? Is a piece of art different than a blender, a particular product? Are the components of what makes it successful different?
You know, we've looked across a whole host of different types of products and ideas. We've looked at newspaper articles online. We've looked at products and services offline. We've looked at B2C and B2B. We've even looked at political ideas at small businesses. And what we find again and again is we see the same principles at work. It's not luck. It's not random. The same six key drivers encourage people to talk and share.
What about generational difference? What do you find in that regard?
Again, it's one of these situations where the similarities swamp the differences. You might think, oh, older people are completely different than younger folks. And you're right, they maybe talk more offline than younger people do. But actually, if you look at the data, there's a surprising statistic. You might think that even young people spend most of their word of mouth online. But if you look at the data, actually only about 7% of word of mouth is online. 7% is on social media, on reviews, on blogs. Much more word of mouth is actually offline, face-to-face. And sure, young people share a little more word of mouth online, more like 15% than 7, but there's still over 70% of what they're talking about is offline. And so while we focus a lot on online behavior, offline word of mouth is just as important.
Talk about the success of something like 50 Shades of Grey that has this rocket-like trajectory for a relatively short period of time and then kind of fades away.
I think there are many aspects of culture that are somewhat transient. You know, here today, gone tomorrow. Many of the viral videos we see online have that quality. They're popular one day, and, you know, a couple months later, they're not. And I think it is hard to stick around. What we found in our research is that things that catch on more quickly actually tend to die out more quickly as well. The fact that they catch on quickly makes people think that there'll be a flash in the pan and makes them less interested. So to stick around is really about providing enduring value. We talk about practical value in the book as a concept of useful information that drives people to share, and that's one reason that things stick around as well.
One of the other aspects is the idea of story, that when people engage in word of mouth and there's chatter about a particular product or idea, that to be successful, it is in the context of stories.
People don't like being walking advertisements. No one wants to walk up to someone and just tell them product features. But we do love telling stories. We do love sharing narratives. What I think we often don't notice, though, is that stories themselves can be Trojan horses. We all remember that old story of the Trojan horse, where the Greeks hid inside the wooden horse to go into the city of Troy. And stories are sort of like that. They have things hidden inside them, whether they be morals, you know, the boy cried wolf is all about not lying, whether they be information about products and ideas. We may be talking about ourselves and how we got upgraded to first class on a flight, But along the way, we end up talking about the airline and mentioning the brand name. And so one key thing to help people talk about or share your ideas is to figure out how to build a Trojan horse story, a narrative that has an engaging outside but also carries the brand or the benefit as part of the narrative.
How important, then, is it that these stories be in the framework of stories that are archetypes? I mean, The Boy Who Cried Wolf is a good example.
I think archetypal stories definitely help make the story more engaging, and there's some rules to think about storytelling itself and how you make a better story. But the key here is not just to tell a good story. It's to tell a good story that carries your message along for the ride. You might make a great piece of content, a really engaging narrative, but if no one mentions you as part of that narrative, it's not going to help you out at the end of the day. If you're an accountant and someone tells a story about a great experience they had, but they never mention the name of your firm, it's not going to help you get new business. And so it's really not just about creating engaging stories, but creating engaging stories that carry your message along for the ride.
One of the conflicts that seems to be inherent throughout is that people want both new and to be on the cutting edge, but at the same time, they want things that make them feel comfortable. Talk about that inner conflict.
There is a great tension between similarity and difference, between being similar to everyone else and being different from others, and how to make that tension work. We want to be similar, and we like familiar things because it's more comfortable. The more we've seen something, the more experienced it, the easier it is to deal with. But we also like novelty. We like differentiation. We like to be different than others. And so psychologists talk about an idea called optimal distinctiveness that says how we navigate those two things. We want to be similar in some ways and different than others. We want to have the car that helps us show off our newfound status, but get it a color that's different from the other folks at work. And so often our behavior allows us to be similar and different at the same time.
And how does that tension play into us deciding what products we're going to buy, what things we're going to pursue? How does it play into this idea of making things contagious?
I think that's an interesting question that we haven't necessarily studied enough yet. But similarity and difference is definitely important. If you look at baby names, for example, or you look at what books are popular, or even movies, you do see trends where we go with something that's been somewhat similar, that is familiar, but also different in some ways. So 50 Shades of Grey, actually, you asked about that big hit, actually started out as Twilight fan fiction. It actually started out very related to something that was already quite popular, but was a spin-off. And I think that helped it become popular along the way. You see the same thing with baby names or with movies. They have something in common with names that have been popular, but also do something different to create that sense of novelty as well.
Does the novelty of technology play any role in what you see unfolding in these areas?
I think there tends to be a focus on technology and quality, the notion that the most high-tech or best product will win. And that's true sometimes, but it's not true always. Lots of times, actually, even lower quality technology wins out, or something that's not as good becomes popular. And what it points to is it's not just about quality or about technology. It's also about social influence. We tend to follow others, even if what they're doing is not necessarily the best thing for everyone.
Talk a little bit about the research that went into this, and whether the research was in the analysis of individuals and the analysis of groups and their behavior, or did it come from the other side in looking at large quantities of data and working backwards from that?
We've done both sides. So we've looked at 6 months of New York Times articles, over 7,000 articles released by the paper, to understand what makes online content go viral. But we've also done experiments in the laboratory where we ask students or people to have conversations and see what they talk about. We've analyzed millions, hundreds of millions of baby names and how baby names change over time. But we've also looked at how people make everyday choices in the lab. And so we've done both. We've come at it from both angles to get a deeper understanding of how behavior works.
Jonah Berger, his book is Contagious, Why Things Catch On. Jonah, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.